areas like Swansea, and then we go through some of these tours. Just so that we're all on the same page. So we start with the fairy estuary. So it is where the rivers meet the oceans, and the sound can be something that's like a large endowment, like the waterfall of the Chesapeake Bay, for example, as an estuary. But it can also be more land estuaries that we have here on the south shore of Massachusetts, where there are these coastal rivers that flow down to the ocean. And there are segments of those rivers that become tidal. And the salinity, the saltiness of the water changes throughout the day. And estuaries are very special places that provide food and shelter for lots of different organisms. They're very protective environment. And so they are crucial in the ecology of our coasts here. Which brings us to the Swansea itself. So when I tell people what I do for my job, sometimes, depending on who I answer, what I'm kind of speaking to, change what I call myself. Sometimes they say I'm writing just because people understand what that sort of means. More typically, I say I'm a coastal ecologist or an estuary ecologist. But we use this word ecology, but maybe don't always understand exactly what it means. So, ecology comes from two Greek words. I do like entomology, that's ETY. Entomology is the study of insects. Entomology, the study of the roots of words. So, ecology comes from two Greek words, oikos and logos. So, oikos means house or environment, and logos means study of. So, after the study, you have sort of the study of the environment, where different organisms or living things live in. So, ecology is really about these organisms interacting with their environment and the relationships between the organisms and their environment and the processes that occur, both natural interactions between living things as well as things like geologic processes. So, the other term that I use, which is actually my title for my job at the North and South Rivers Watershed Association, is Watershed Ecologist. It's the name of the organization itself. So, what is a watershed? This is something that we include in the SWA's fifth grade water level energy curriculum that we take to the schools, and you'd be surprised how few people know what a watershed is. Some people are like, joke, they go outside of a building or take water or something like that. But a watershed is the area where all the water is drained into the same place. So, a watershed would be absolutely huge. Most majority of the country, the United States, is in the Mississippi River watershed. So, a lot of the rain that is falling on the Grand Trail of the United States happens to flow toward the Mississippi and go out to Gulf of Mexico at some point. So, when it rains and the water is running down your driveway, where is that water going? It's always going to be flowing somehow toward the ocean. Water is going toward the ocean. It's really surprising finding out exactly the path that that water would take. In a lot of cases, that water might be artificially guided in a certain direction. In many cases, that's due to stormwater infrastructure. So, when it's raining, that water is falling on the ground. When that is precipitation, that's one piece of the water cycle.
Transpired through the leaves during the growing season. So, there's water on the surface in our rivers, there's also water under the ground. And I want to just talk a little bit about some of the alterations that can occur to this water cycle. So, one of the things that I wanted to talk about that's sort of pertinent right now is the concept of drought. So it is September right now, and right now we are at the lowest point, roughly, in the natural hydrologic cycle. So stream flow and the amount of water in our rivers goes up and down throughout the year. That's going to increase the flow in the rivers. And then during the summer, as the trees and the plants are transplanted, as there's just warmer weather, more evaporation, and less precipitation, we start to see lower natural stream flows in our streams. However, this is also exacerbated by our impacts on our rivers and our groundwater. So in the summer, people use a lot of water, more water, water use actually kills during the summer. And a lot of that is due to irrigation. And smaller sites, it can be used, it can be more indoor water use, but generally it tends to be increased outdoor water use through mostly irrigation. So we have this little natural hydrologic cycle anyway, and then that gets exacerbated by increased water withdrawals. And as you to get underground, that's where our wells are drawn from. And that groundwater and that surface water together provide stream flow together. So, how do we know when we are having a drought? And that's a question that I have heard before. And there's sort of a couple of different ways that you can figure out. Just observation, really. So the U.S. Drought Monitor, which is actually a you can visit. So how much water is falling? It's based on stream flow. It's based on groundwater levels, based on reservoir levels, and also crop moisture and a fire index. So in case you don't know, at least as of the last evaluation, these things were not in any level of drought, never indicating drought. But these entities can often be delayed because the top turnaround time can get out of the information and put it into the index and get that index out to the public, can result in a delay. So another way that you can take a look and see how drought might be affecting your local stream or river is by checking out the USGS stream gauges. And you can look up your closest stream gauge on the USGS website and find out what the stream flows are like. So in the case of the North and South Rivers, the gauge that we use is the Indian Head gauge. So the Indian Head River is one of the two headwater rivers to North River. It's the one that has a greater volume. The other is the Hine Brook. So for those who are local, Indian Head River runs up through Hanover, between Hanover and Pembroke, and the Hine Brook goes up into Pembroke as well. And the Indiana gauge has 52 years of record. So, whereas 52 years that stream flow has been measured every day, throughout the day, and with that data, we're able to calculate statistics on those flows on a daily basis or a monthly basis or a yearly basis. And the statistics that I typically use was stream flow, which is measured in CFS or cubic feet per second. The stream flows statistics are typically things like medians or percentiles. So if you have a median daily stream flow, it would be the stream flow not from that day over the past 52 years of record, say that the median head gauge stream flow has exceeded that particular flow half the time. So it's been below it half the time. It has been below it half the time. So it's in the middle, it's the median flow. If you want to list what the stream flow is every day, over the past 52 years, I have been in the middle of the list. So you can go to the USGS website, and you can look up your local stream gauge. And if you're, again, in the North and South areas, you can look up the Indian Head gauge. There's also a gauge on the Jones River in Kingston, if you live a little further south, and see what stream flows are looking like, and see how close they are to that median. And the website will give you gives you a nice graph showing you the stream flows and the medians are put out there. And it'll also give you the numerical data. So in this case today, as of the middle of today, stream flows at the median were actually 66.4%. So they were a little bit higher than normal. And I shouldn't say normal. Well, a little bit higher than the median. And which that's why they're a little bit higher. But over time, looking at stream flows at this time, we're gonna have these low stream flows. So as of recently having this rain, they're a little bit higher. But in general, our stream flows actually have been pretty low recently. I was out doing kibble counts the other day in the third ground group with the Division of Ecological Restoration. I was walking through the stream. When you do kibble counts, you're walking along and you pick up whatever sand or gravel or stone or maybe too big to pick up, maybe a large pebble or boulder is in front of your foot, and you walk in a slow zigzag through the stream until you measure 100 pieces of stone or gravel or pebbles, what have you. So we're trying to get to characterize the sand movement after the Tech Factory dam removal 2 years ago. So we had done it prior to the removal, which was the last summer, and this was the third time that we've done it. So we were walking along the stream, and the stream flows were really low. We got up in the stream the week prior as well, and gone a little further upstream, and again, very low stream flows, just a trickle. And in one case, we did find a pool that had sort of a strand, well, it was stranded, had a strand in a redfin pickerel, which is a fish that lives in the stream, just sort of stranded in this little pool. So these low stream flows are a concern to us. It's always something that we're trying to keep an eye on. So there's not much obviously we can do about how much it rains. But what we can do is try to stay water as much as possible, because these streams are fed by surface flow enclosed cell. But there are other things that layer their streams of nanometrics that resonate first with both an integral and a stream atom, a wave stream atom, is a chemtech or a lot of different organisms. And the stream itself is actually doing things like move something. Various particles of organic particles and inorganic particles downstream. And from something that is really important to us as well is the availability of water for fish migration. And so it's been the next episodes are short, and we will focus in depth in the juvenile fish are there. And those juvenile fish have to get back out to the ocean. And they start running out as early as July, or they may wait until the end of summer. In some cases, when their hands have been in upstream flow, they actually have to wait until the next year. And that has a big impact on river herring populations. So a lot of people think about those juvenile fish and fish passage. And terrible and things like that. And those are very common part of it. We don't always tell those things. But the forgotten part of the life cycle that is just as crucial as getting those baby fish back out to the ocean so that they can grow up and then come back into our rivers. And that is where these low stream flows and dry streams end up affecting the cycles of those fish. So, a lot more and fellow migratory fish in the kind of sense. But, just the low stream flow perspective on how these fish are affected by not having a lot of water. So, another way that we can alter the water cycle is through affecting how quickly that water is running over the surface. And again, that does feed into these issues of high and low water in our streams. Because when you have what's called a flashy flow over an impervious or hard surface, that water is traveling faster. And for a given amount of water, it's much more likely to become surface flow than soak into the groundwater, and or soak into the rainwater, become rainwater. And the process of water soaking through the rain also cleans that water. Right? So if it's running over a hard surface, it will pick up pollution. So there is stormwater pollution, also called non-point source pollution. And that term, non-point source pollution, comes from the idea. commercial where the peg adheres to the clay crystal metabolism, kind of in the form of nutrients and bacteria. So you, if you live at a level of rapid self-areas or a level of any other, whatever that has swimming or has shellfish in, you know that there's an impact when we have rain. So we see our data at SRWI and our river actually that when we have rain, we tend to get higher bacterial levels. And the bacteria is coming from a web of different places. It can come from just animals living around the rivers. Some cases, it's coming from dog waste, people that are picking up after their dogs, or people, you know, having their dogs just out in their yards. A water actually is more of an impervious surface than a pervious surface, in the way it behaves, you know, depending on how you're taking care of it. So, we have bacteria that's coming into our rivers, from stormwater. And that can make the water unsafe to swim. And it can also close shellfish beds. So that is one of the reasons why we monitor for bacteria in the rivers, as we're trying to understand the effect of this rainfall and also provide information for the public about different places. Now we have to definitely remain a huge area on that, because while we do sample the bacteria as part of our monitoring during the summer, that is not what is essentially telling you you should not go swimming. If there are public locations like public swimming beaches, those are things that are getting tested by the tanks. And the State Department of Public Health also tests bacteria in public swimming locations. And we'll probably get into bacterial testing, water quality testing, in a later episode. But I wanted to highlight the effects of stormwater and bacterial pollution in this episode, at least. The other big thing that comes from runoff, stormwater runoff, is nutrient pollution. So, nutrients in this case are nitrogen and phosphorus. And these are things that are in wastewater, but they're also in fertilizers. You know, when you go and buy a bag of fertilizer, it'll show you the nutrient ratio on there. And nutrients have the same effect on things that grow in the ocean and in the estuarine and the pond and the lake. And so when you apply them to your water, they increase the growth of these plants and then things like plants. So, it can cause problems, and one of these problems is something called eutrophication. So, eutrophication occurs when you have excess nutrients that are entering the water body, and those excess nutrients cause a massive growth in mostly things like plants and algae that are living in the water. And all of that biomass, all that living material, can only be sustained by those nutrients for so long. So that plant material and that algae eventually will die off, and then that gets digested and broken down by bacteria, and that process pulls oxygen out of the water. Because there's oxygen that is dissolved in the water, and it's another thing that, you know, is ingestion. And they can cause things like fish scales. And the generally acceptable thing is that nitrogen is the limiting nutrient in saltwater and industrialized, and phosphorus is the limiting nutrient in freshwater. So this concept of a limiting nutrient is like talking about an essential element of a recipe. So when you are building something that is alive, if you're producing biomass, that biomass is being held by the existence of certain building blocks. So this recipe for to make things and make living things that contain nitrogen and phosphorus. And you are limited in how much of this biomass you can build by how many blocks you have. So I like to always think of it as like a cookie recipe. Say you are making a recipe for chocolate chip cookies, and in order to make your chocolate chip cookies, you need you're doing your full recipe of chocolate chip cookies. You need to have a cup of chocolate chips. You go to the cabinet and you dig through and have all this available ingredient. answer to this question. So, often, and you'll so much for listening. Again, if you have questions or have ideas for future episodes, please tweet.